Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the welter of this week's news, of which there's been a welter, hence the weltering, you probably didn't miss the appearance by former Secretary of State and most recently Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton at the Recode Tech Conference this week. It did make some news, elbowing through everything else, mostly because Mrs. Clinton, first of all, said, "I take responsibility for all of my decisions," and then said immediately afterwards, "That's not why I lost," and then proceeded to enumerate a series of reasons why supposedly she lost, a list which is growing longer every time she enumerates it. This time it included shortcomings in the data operations of the Democratic National Committee. I think that recurled Debbie Wasserman Schultz's hair, hearing that. But I, you know, apparently this is something that, now she was asked a question about it, that's in her defense, but other people were asked similar questions about other things and had different answers. So, for example, in the administration in which she served as Secretary of State, just as it was a warning, her president, her chief executive, former president, was asked what he was going to do about the apparently well-grounded allegations that members of the previous administration had engaged in human rights violations and torture. And you may recall his answer.
We're still evaluating how we are going to approach the whole issue of interrogations, detentions, and so forth. On the other hand, I also have a belief that we need to look forward as opposed to looking backwards.
So hear that, Mrs. Clinton? And ladies and gentlemen, this is a weekend fraught with the story of the most recent terrorist attack in London. I, as you know, originate this program from London on occasion. I like London a lot. I have very good friends there. This is for London. Hello, welcome to the show.
London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Whoa, Liza, see the Costa barrows, the vegetable marrows, and the fruit piled high. Oh, Liza, little London sparrows, Covent Garden Market where the costas cry. Cockney feet mark the beat of history. Every street pins a memory down. Nothing ever can quite replace the grace of London town. There's a little city flower every spring unfailing, growing in the crevices by some London railing. Though it has a Latin name, in town and countryside, we in England call it London Pride. London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Hey, lady, when the day is dawning, see the policeman yawning on his lonely beat. Gay lady, Mayfair in the morning, hear your footsteps echo in the empty street. Early rain and the pavement's glistening, all Park Lane in a shimmering gown. Nothing ever could break or harm the charm of London town. In our city darkened now, street and square and crescent, we can feel our living past In our shadowed present, ghosts beside our starlit Thames, who lived and loved and died, keep throughout the ages London pride. London pride has been handed down to us. London pride is a flower that's free. London pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Grey city, stubbornly implanted, taken so for granted for a thousand years. Stay city, smokily enchanted, cradle of our memories, our hopes and fears. Every blitz your resistance toughening, from the Ritz to the Anchor and Crown, nothing ever could override the pride of London town.
From New Orleans, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. How about our freedom-loving friends in Saudi Arabia? Just so recently, just a tiny little bit of time ago, President Trump was there shaking hands with King Salman, who was in season, it turns out, and signing a deal to sell him $100 billion plus worth of new weaponry, which they're only going to use against the Yemenis. But now there's this, a meeting between the two men who run Russia and Saudi Arabia's oil empires has occurred, suggesting a new relationship between the energy superpowers. This was the first time that the boss of Rosneft, that's the Russian energy company, Igor Sechin, and the head of Saudi Aramco, Amin Nasser, the first time they had a formal scheduled meeting. They, you know, said, oh, hi to each other, the way, let's say, Putin and Mike Flynn did. But this is different. Their conversation also broke new ground, according to Reuters, quoting two sources familiar with the talks in the Saudi city of Dharan, not Iran, Dharan, last week. So the CEOs discussed possible ways of cooperating in Asia, such as Indonesia and India. They, like, had to enumerate what Asia might mean. The sources didn't disclose further details. Any cooperation on Asia between Russia and Saudi Arabia, who happen to be the world's two biggest oil exporters, would be interesting, perhaps unprecedented. Aramco confirmed the meeting took place, declined to give details of the closed-door talks. That the talks took place on the same day as Saudi Arabia, the head of OPEC, and Russia, not in OPEC, agreed to extend a cut in the rate of crude oil output in an attempt to keep oil prices from plummeting further. The meeting will be, or the relationship in captured in the meeting. Did I say encaptured? Spotlighted by the meeting, will be closely watched by big oil consumers around the world, who have long relied on the rivalry between Russia and Saudi Arabia to keep prices down and secure better deals. Good deals! Such a detente between Moscow and Riyadh would have been almost unthinkable in the past. Until a year ago, the two sides had virtually no dialogue at all, even in the face of the spike in U.S. shale oil production that led to the collapse in global oil prices. Last year, Rosneft outbid Aramco to buy an India refinery and boost Russia's share in the world's fastest-growing fuel market, India. Now, Russia and Riyadh have become the main protagonists of the pact to cut output, agreed to last December and then extended, and are even discussing possible cooperation in Asia. Said one senior Gulf official, it is a new axis of love. And by axis, he means attempted cartel. And on the subject of our freedom-loving friends in Saudi Arabia, an investigation into the foreign funding of extremist Islamist groups by the British government may never be published. The British government's Home Office now admits as much. According to the British newspaper The Independent, The inquiry was commissioned by former Prime Minister David Cameron. Remember him? He used to be a thing. It was launched as part of a deal with his coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, back when there was such a thing, in exchange for the Liberal Democrats supporting British airstrikes against ISIS into Syria. They'd been only striking in Iraq before that. Although it was due to be published spring last year, it's a year late, but, you know, these studies take... It has not been completed and may never be made public due to its, quote, sensitive contents. It's thought to focus on our freedom-loving friends in Saudi Arabia, which Britain recently approved about $5 billion worth of arms export licenses to. Spokesperson for the Home Office told The Independent a decision on the publication of the report would be taken after this week's election by the next government, kicking the can down the week. In a separate interview with The Guardian, however, a spokesperson said the report may never be published, describing its contents as, quote, very sensitive. But that's not all.
Once I had a secret that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret became impatient to be free. And my secret's no secret anymore.
Well, maybe it is. The Justice Department's copy in the United States of the famed torture report from the Senate Intelligence Committee may not be returning to the Senate anytime soon, despite what we heard this week that all the copies were going to be returned to the Senate, where they could not be accessed by Freedom of Information requests, because that's how the law works. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who chaired the Intelligence Committee when the panel produced the report in 2014, said over the weekend she's confirmed that the CIA, its Inspector General, and the Director of National Intelligence have all returned their copies of the torture report to the Senate. Her successor is the chair, Senator Burr of North Carolina, had asked the administration to return its copies to the Senate, where it could be blocked indefinitely from public view. The courts, said Burr, have ruled that it's a congressional document. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions pledged to Feinstein in written responses during his confirmation process that he would not return the Justice Department's copy to the Senate. Asked whether that's still the Attorney General's view, a Department of Justice spokeswoman said the department's copy of the report is tied up in the courts, which raises the prospect it could stay there for years. Secret courts? We don't know. Shh. The report is the subject of two district court orders, and pursuant to those orders has been lodged with the court information security officers for the District Court of the District of Columbia, said the FLAC for the Department of Justice. Copies of the 2014 report were distributed to the CIA and its Inspector General, the FBI, the Director of National Intelligence, as well as Justice, State Departments, and the Pentagon, with the eventual goal of making it public. That's why it was sent to the executive branch in the first place. A military judge has also ordered the Defense Department to preserve a copy of the report in connection with a prosecution pending against the alleged conspirators in the 9/11 thing. That's not going to be public, because none of that is kind of almost none of that. There is a wonderful reporter from the Miami Herald who covers all the those military commission proceedings on Twitter and in the Miami Herald. But that's about it. Burr asked the Obama administration to return all executive branch copies to the Senate when he became chairman of the committee. The issue has been tied up in the courts, with the ACLU suing to make the report public. The Supreme Court declined to hear that case. I guess the Obama administration could have ordered all of its departments not to cooperate with Senator Burr and even to make the report public, but it didn't. Multiple judges have ordered the report be preserved in court records, and former President Obama did include another copy as a part of his White House paperwork with the National Archives, meaning it could be released as early as 2029. That's good work. News of secrets, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, there's obviously So much in the news about President Trump this week, centering primarily on his decision announced Friday to withdraw the United States from the Paris Accord on climate change, which seems to have, well, the whole week of, or this whole period of time has seemed to have driven some folks a little close to the edge, if not over it. Stephen Colbert's memorable remark about the president's mouth being suitable only as a repository for Vladimir Putin's sexual organ. He put it more bluntly than that on television, but there was, you know, it was network television. And then Bill Maher this week. So on a not the same subject, but just the something's going on. Anyway, it's not going on here. I think it's time to maybe take a somewhat more musical approach to what's going on. So today, two selections from the ever-growing Donald Trump songbook. As you may recall, the week began with a bit of a mystery. He, as it is his wont, was on whatever he was sitting on, whether it has a hole in it or not, tweeting in the middle of the night, and started a sentence with "despite the," and then the next word in the tweet, and the last word in the tweet was "covfefe." I'm sure you're familiar with this story by now. There was no end to the sentence; it just trailed off like that. Few people focused on the fact that it just trailed off like that because the word itself was so fascinating and mysterious. And Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, only added to the mystery at one of his soon-to-be last briefings by saying, "President meant exactly what he said."
You know, once I could fly in my plane through the sky to a place that was called Covfefe. Like some kind of dream, it was champagne and cream. People would call me El Jefe. But where is it now? I wrinkle my brow, but I can't find my way back to Covfefe. Say, there's no friggin' way. There's a place that's so beachy and leafy. My head I would shake. I'd say it's not fake, and it's probably called Covfefe. But was it a trap? You know, I look at the map. There's no place called Covfefe. Now it's too late. There's too much on my plate to search for a refuge so reefy. The skeptics are right. I gave up the fight to return to the calm of Covfefe. My fantasy I have renounced. My paradise is thoroughly trounced. I don't know how the hell it's pronounced. Covfefe. 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 Covfefe.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the atom. It's our friend.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too
Out of the atom. Yes, sir. Guilty as charged. It's summertime.
I know, I'm spinning like crazy.
It speeds you up, right?
Yeah, it does. Heat speeds up the thing.
The thing?
Yeah, I'm not up on the lingo.
Of your own?
Of my own physiology. I'm an atom. What do you want from me?
Okay, good. We got that settled.
It was an impertinent question to begin with.
Now, let's get to news of our friend the atom.
I was waiting.
Wait no more. As the United States continues to grapple with long-term storage of radioactive spent fuel from the nation's nuclear power plants.
Well, it was spent. It was well spent.
Thank you. Science watchdogs are warning of serious flaws with the current storage method, which involves densely packing the combustible spent fuel assemblies under at least 20 feet of water in pools located at individual plants while we wait for the creation of a permanent repository, which don't exist yet.
Well, yeah, it's a long time.
Mm-hmm. The warning came in an issue just out of the journal Science.
Oh, that.
Yeah. In an article entitled Nuclear Safety Regulation in the Post-Fuk Era, Flawed Analyses Underlie Lax U.S. Regulation of Spent Fuel.
And that's just a headline.
Yes. Following Fuk, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission ordered a comprehensive review of regulations. While the buildings that housed Fuk's spent fuel pools were destroyed, the spent fuel fortunately remained covered with enough water to keep the metal cladding that encloses the uranium from catching fire.
You don't want that.
You don't. Scientists working for the NRC estimated that a fire in one of the plant's pools would have dramatically increased the amount of radioactive pollution released, could have led to the forced long-term relocation of between 1.5 and 35 million people from Japan's east coast rather than the 150,000 that were evacuated.
That's a lot of people. But they're...
What?
No, nothing.
You were going to go Bill Maher on me, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
The NRC adopted a number of safety upgrades after the Fuk disaster, but rejected a measure to end the dense packing of the spent fuel pools located in nuclear plants across the U.S., a technique that utilities use for the best of reasons.
To reduce costs?
That's right. Says the United States, after all. The authors say the screening process that was used by the NRC failed to adequately account for the impacts of, quote, large-scale land contamination events from spent fuel pool fires.
Say that very fast.
Spent fuel pool fires.
Okay, I lose.
The NRC's own technical evaluation estimated that a fire in a densely packed spent fuel pool at the Peach Bottom plant in Pennsylvania, just north of the Maryland border, would require the evacuation of 4.1 million people from an area of over 9,000 square miles. Unless the NRC improves its approach to assessing risks and benefits of safety improvements by using more realistic parameters in its quantitative assessments and also taking into account societal impacts.
You mean like on people?
Yeah. The United States will remain needlessly vulnerable to such disasters, the authors warn. According to the Congressional Research Service, two of the five states with the largest amount of spent nuclear fuel stored in wet pools are North Carolina and Alabama. The others are Illinois, Pennsylvania, and New York.
Nothing, right? Red and blue.
Under the NRC's current rules, which the authors say are self-imposed, the potential solution for the storage problem, moving the spent fuel from pools to air-cooled dry storage casks after a few years, could be adopted only if the monetary value of the resulting public risk reduction were to exceed the cost of implementation. And if the increase in safety were, quote, substantial. Those are the two rules the NRC uses to judge whether it's worth changing the method of storage. The estimated cost transferring the spent fuel to dry cask storage is $5
billion. I got that on me.
The NRC's analysis assumed the chance of a fire resulting in a large release of radioactive pollution would be small, though with considerable uncertainty. Its risk analysis also failed to account for a possible terrorist attack. Those don't happen. No. And made other assumptions that minimize the estimated health and economic consequences of a high-density fuel pool fire.
Say that real fast.
Fuel pool fire. For example, it ignored an accident consequences beyond 50 miles.
Well, radiation doesn't travel.
All right, then. And assumed radiation dose standards for population relocation that were less restrictive than those recommended by the EPA.
Well, that's going to change.
In addition, the NRC overlooked the societal risks of accidents, such as the psychological trauma of mass relocation. In our view, if the NRC were to use more realistic quantitative assessments and give weight to societal impacts, a requirement to expedite transfer of spent fuel to dry casks would be justified, conclude the authors.
Yeah, but they're just authors.
In science.
Blinded by it.
A partially collapsed... Oh, let's go to Hanford. The nuclear reservation in Washington State. I am sure you've heard of it. And it now has its own theme.
What?
No, that would not be its theme. So we'll not do that. Or maybe we will. Let's try once more. It'll be fun.
I'm waiting.
Here we go. Its own theme. There we are. A partially collapsed waste storage tunnel at the Hanford nuclear plant will be filled with grout.
Shut up.
To further stabilize it, according to the Department of Energy. As we cannot quickly determine the exact cause of the partial collapse of the tunnel, the rest of the tunnel is still subject to collapse, said Doug Shoup, manager of the Hanford Operations Office.
Shoup, 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 shoup.
Oh, you're getting into that funky thing, huh?
I sure am.
The State Department of Ecology, a Hanford regulator, agrees with the plan. About a month ago, Hanford workers discovered a section of the tunnel roof about 20 feet long had collapsed, potentially exposing equipment with highly radioactive contamination stored in the tunnel. An emergency was declared and initial steps taken to stabilize the tunnel. It holds 8 flatbed rail cars loaded with contaminated equipment from the nearby plutonium processing plant. The breach was filled with a mixture of sand and soil.
That's my favorite mixture.
And then a layer of heavy plastic was pulled over the length of the tunnel.
Tarp.
Yeah, another TARP program. Both DOE and the state agree on the advantages of filling the tunnel with concrete-like grout. It would help stabilize the tunnel, which is built mostly of creosoted timbers. I'm not going to say that 3 times. It would encase the rail cars and the equipment they hold in place and would provide shielding from radiation. The tunnel can't be filled completely to the top with grout, but leaving it mostly full means if another portion of the tunnel roof collapses, there would be far less risk.
I like grout.
And Hanford's owner, the Department of Energy, is scrambling to deal with a second emergency at the site. In a couple weeks, signs have emerged that a massive underground double-shell nuclear waste-holding tank may be leaking. The tank is known as AZ-101. It was put into service way back in 1976. Its life was expected to be 20 years. Now it has been holding hot, boiling, radioactive, and chemically contaminated waste for 41 years.
It's a good tank.
A 7-person crew deployed a remote control device into the safety space of the double-shell tank. And the radiation specialist for the crew spotted higher-than-expected readings. Found radioactive material on 1 worker in 3 spots. Contaminated items were removed, bagged, and appropriately disposed of. Everybody was freaked, shocked, surprised, a veteran worker told King 5 News in Seattle. Contamination was not expected. They're not supposed to find contamination in the annulus.
Excuse me.
It's a safety perimeter of the double-shelled tanks.
Well, that's an annulus horribilis.
You almost said it right. Okay, that's enough of Hanford. Southern Company's chief executive has said more than once that the utility's project to build 2 more nuclear plants at Plant Vogtle in Georgia would be history-making. He may be right, but in a different way. Years behind schedule, billions over budget, and with a key contractor's bankruptcy clouding its future, the troubled project near Augusta is fast becoming Exhibit A for why no U.S. utility before Southern had tried building a new reactor in 30-plus years. Most Georgians who get electric bills could eventually pay for overruns on the project. They are likely to grow, according to the Atlanta Journal. Customers of Southern subsidiary Georgia Power already pay a surcharge related to the 2 new nuclear plants. About $100 a year to the average residential bill is added. The ultimate effect on ratepayers, yet to be determined, also uncertain, is how the project will be done because Westinghouse Electric, the company that designed the new reactors and is the primary contractor on the project, has filed for bankruptcy.
That doesn't mean you can't, does it?
You can, you I don't know what it means you can't. Southern California Edison violated procedural requirements in building the storage facility it's relying on to secure millions of pounds of nuclear waste generated by the failed San Onofre nuclear plant. That's according to
anti-nuclear activists?
The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Oh, close. Had the word nuclear in it.
According to an 11-page inspection report issued this week, Edison failed to properly test the density of the grout.
There's that grout again.
Placed under the stainless steel containers that will house the spent fuel assemblies. The oversight was discovered by company officials, corrected soon thereafter, the report notes. Once properly tested, the grout met the standard.
It's easy to overlook grout, isn't it?
I guess. For the third straight year, the Three Mile Island nuclear plant has been shut out of a key auction to sell its power.
It's still in business?
Yeah, one of the plants is. Intensifying the chances that the country's most famous nuke facility will close in 2 years. Owner Exelon issued a statement acknowledging the TMA for a third straight year did not sell power at the auction by a firm that controls power in parts of 13 states. Success at the auction could have guaranteed the sale of Three Mile Island power in 2020 and 2021. It will likely sell its electricity to the grid piecemeal, but the power auction is a staple for the plant's stability. TMI has been losing money for 5 years. No decision has been made. It's too early to speculate on when that decision might be made, said Exelon spokeswoman Lacey Dean. However, we cannot continue to afford to lose money at TMI, she said.
Oh, go on. Keep losing.
Oh, nice. PG&E customers in Northern California won a respite last week from more energy bill increases when state regulators blocked the utility's request to recover nearly $1.5 billion in added costs for retiring its Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant.
Retirement is costly, apparently. That's why they have Social Security, isn't it?
Yeah, for people. And Dateline Boise, Idaho. Some cleanup efforts at a nuclear waste landfill in eastern Idaho are on hold while workers try to figure out what caused a collapse in a dig area that sent an excavator into a pit.
I blame the pit.
The excavator was digging up transuranic waste, contaminated with highly radioactive elements. No radiation was released during the incident, and the excavator has now been rescued from the pit.
I'd give the excavator the weekend off.
Clean, cheap, too hardworking to meet her. Our friend the atom.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will.
From New Orleans, this is Le Show. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you watch CNN on a mobile device because I travel a lot and because I don't like cable. I end up watching CNN on a mobile device a lot. And the good news is you don't see a lot of the commercials that you see if you watch CNN on cable. I haven't been hectored to ask my doctor about whether something is right for me in a while now because of that. On the other hand, you are treated to some what are called house ads, that is to say, commercials for CNN itself, I guess, because they can't yet convince advertisers that it's worth reaching CNN viewers on mobile. I don't know. But anyway, this is one that gets played a lot. And it, to me, just is a little clue as to why the media has, the mainstream media enjoys a trust problem right now. Listen closely.
No one asks us to go. Not friends, not family. No one asks us to go. Into the storm, into the chaos, into the heartbreak. It's the story that drives us forward. It's the story that needs to be heard. It's the story that needs to be told. This is why we go.
We have breaking news out of Greece.
That's why they go. And they have breaking news out of Greece. When is the last time you saw a news story about Greece on CNN? Now, the answer is not, there's no news from Greece. I think this coming week or this past week, I might have been watching too much CNN to be able to tell you, Greece is getting or was got another lashing from its financial masters at the European Union and the IMF, called a bailout, but with another set of very restrictive austerity measures, despite the fact that the International Monetary Fund has said, now a couple years ago, Greece has no way of repaying its debt, and its economy will not recover until the European Union and its fellows accord Greece debt relief. Currently, the youth unemployment rate in Greece is 50%. The general unemployment rate in Greece is 25%. Imagine if that were happening here. It would be on CNN. But there's more news from outside. It's a big bubble. There's more news from it outside it. Yes, there's bad stuff going on all over the world. We know about some of it. Now here's some of the rest of it. Myanmar must do more to prevent the drastic escalation of religious intolerance and violence following clashes between ultra-nationalist Buddhists and minority Muslims in Yangon. That's the conclusion of a senior United Nations envoy. Speaking to The Guardian, Yangi Li, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar, called on the year-old government led by Aung San Suu Kyi to strengthen its efforts to curb hate speech and violence drummed up by nationalist Buddhists. Think of it. Okay, you can stop thinking about it now. I have in the past raised concerns regarding incidents of hate speech, incitement to discrimination, hatred and violence, and of religious intolerance, and these appear to be drastically escalating, said the UN Special Rapporteur. I believe, she said, that the spread of anti-Muslim sentiments and rhetoric is not receiving the serious attention that it requires and is too often left unchecked by the authorities. This cannot be tolerated any longer, quote, unquote. Last week, a fight broke out in a Muslim neighborhood of Yangon after dozens of nationalists raided a home of a family they believed was hiding Rohingya, members of a persecuted minority of Muslims, deemed by many to be illegal immigrants. The violence, which left several injured, came 2 weeks after another radical group involving some of the same people forced the closure of two Islamic schools. The Myanmar authorities have arrested several Buddhists in connection with the recent violence, but they bowed to nationalist pressure and shuttered the Islamic schools. A spokesman for Aung San Suu Kyi declined to take questions, saying he was in a meeting that would last all day. And Al Jazeera reports a cholera epidemic is sweeping Yemen. People are dying by the thousands in a country that Saudi Arabia is bombing with material supplied in a terrific deal by the United States. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Mayor of Kirbyville, Texas, Frank George, told a crime website earlier this week in support of the battled school superintendent Tommy Wallace that speculation and rumors about the superintendent's conduct came from, quote, rednecks who can't debate an issue. A couple of days later, on his private Facebook page, George apologized for his, quote, bad choice of words. He also posted a notice distancing his social media comments from opinions of the city. Three former Penn State officials are getting jail time for failing to report convicted sexual predator Jerry Sandusky to authorities. Former Penn State President Graham Spanier and former Vice President Gary Schultz will have to spend 2 months in jail. Former Athletic Director Tim Curley will spend 3 months in jail. The rest of their sentences will be house arrest. Sentencing guidelines had called for up to a year in prison. Mike McQuarrie, a graduate coaching assistant, told administrators that he saw Sandusky molesting a boy in a football team shower in 2001. Spanier, Curley, and Schultz didn't report Sandusky to child welfare authorities or police. Why he was allowed to continue at Penn State facilities is beyond me, said the judge. All three ignored the opportunity to put an end to his crimes. The three former Penn State officials all apologized for their actions and to Sandusky's victims before the sentences were handed down. I deeply regret I did not intervene more forcefully, Spanier said. Curley and Schultz also told the court they were sorry they didn't do more. I'm very remorseful I did not comprehend the severity of the situation, said Curley. I sincerely apologize to the victims and to all who were impacted because of my mistake, said Schultz. It really sickens me to think I might have played a part in children being hurt. I'm sorry I didn't do more, and I apologize to the victims, end quote. The controversial scaffold installation, you heard about it here last week, I believe, at the newly renovated Minneapolis Sculpture Garden, will be dismantled, taken to a fort, and ceremonially burned, according to officials at the Walker Art Center. The sculpture partly depicts the mass hanging of 38 members of the Dakota tribe in Mankato, Minnesota, in 1862. It sparked protests last weekend. Elders of the Dakota tribe met with the artist, Los Angeles-based Sam Durant, as well as the city authorities and the art center to discuss the future of the installation. Following the meeting, the neutral mediator for the parties announced the scaffold will be dismantled during a ceremony at the sculpture garden led by Dakota spiritual leaders and elders. The wood will be removed by a native construction company taken to Fort Snelling, where it will eventually be burned during a ceremony. The artist agreed never to replicate the Dakota gallows. He also transfers the intellectual property rights of it to the Dakota people. Durant said he'd done historical research on the events depicted in his work, but admitted he had not met with the people whose ancestors were affected by those events. Quote, I just wanted to apologize for the trauma and suffering that my work has caused in the community, and I felt that very much, Durant, the artist said. There's no question that the Walker's process in placing the sculpture in the sculpture garden was flawed, said the executive director of the Walker Art Center. I apologize we were not sufficiently aware of the implications of its placement or sympathetic to the pain and suffering this would elicit. And Yokohama Mayor Fumiko Hayashi apologized to a 13-year-old boy for the municipal government's failure to act swiftly when he was bullied in elementary school for being a nuclear evacuee from Fuke Prefecture. The mayor said that she vowed to the boy and his mother to more seriously tackle bullying. He was called germ, as a reference to nuclear contamination, by his teacher, and he forked over $13,500 in apparent extortion fees to his classmates. That, ladies and gentlemen, is some bullying. The apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now in other news related to President Trump, of course, his one of the people who was most active in lobbying for him not to get out of the Paris Peace Accords was his daughter Ivanka and her husband, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Kushner's efforts may have been possibly distracted because now he has been named a person of interest. There were reports this week that he had held a previously undisclosed meeting with a Russian banker during the transition period. He remains, according to all reports, among the most trusted, if not the most trusted, of the president's advisors.
person I trust most, son-in-law.
Son-in-law.
He's the butter, I'm the toast, son-in-law.
Son-in-law.
He gives me good advice. He's cheap at half the price. Thinks my daughter's tits are nice. Son-in-law.
Son-in-law.
That's when they call me a clown. Son-in-law.
Son-in-law.
Despite his strong appeal, I didn't like the climate deal. He called me a big slim meal. Son-in-law.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. Store-bought teeth. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Not the teeth, the news. More than 80 American athletes have sent medals they won at Rio to the U.S. Olympic Committee headquarters to be shipped to game organizers who will replace them due to flaking, black spots, and other damage. The Americans, including gold medal wrestlers Snyder and Helen Maroulis, are among at least 100 Olympians from across the globe with defective medals. Beach volleyball star Kerry Walsh Jennings is also in the group. She says her bronze medal is flaking and rusting. USA swimming spokesman Scott Laitman said some swimmers have damaged medals as well. Well, they'll wear them underwater. The USOC learned about the problems in December, reached out to all American sports federations in January to begin the process. Apparently it's a long process, because here we are in June. Rio Games spokesman Mario Andrada said officials have noticed problems with the covering on 6-7% of the medals. The most common issue is that they were dropped or mishandled and the varnish has come off and they've rusted or gone black in the spot where they were damaged, he said. It's not uncommon for medals to be passed around at post-game parties, but this amount of damage is unusual. Stockholm's mayor has maintained there is no chance of the Swedish capital pressing ahead with the bid for the 2026 Olympic and Paralympic Games, the Winter Games. The Swedish Olympic Committee had claimed they believe they can persuade politicians in the city to change their mind and back the campaign, but the mayor announced her opposition in April due to a lack of political support, as well as a lack of clarity over finances. The Olympic Committee claimed her comments were, quote, premature and probably based on unclear facts, unquote. Attention, Kellyanne Conway. Unclear facts. That's a new one. Deadline Tokyo. A Japanese hotelier who denies that a 1937 massacre by Japanese troops in the Chinese city of Nanjing ever took place. A Nanjing denier has no intention of removing books with his revisionist views from his hotels during the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Tokyo-based hotel and real estate developer APA Group came under fire this week over books by its chief executive, Toshio Motoya, which contain essays in which he says the Nanjing massacre never happened. The books are placed in every room of the company's 400-plus APA hotels. Following protests, including Chinese calls for a boycott of the chain, APA temporarily removed the books from hotels hosting athletes for a sport event on Japan's northern island of Hokkaido. In his latest book, entitled The Real History of Japan, Japan Pride, Motoyo says the so-called Nanking Massacre story is fabricated and blames looting and killings in the city on members of the Chinese army. Well, that'll do it. He says his latest book, the Japanese army merely exposed and put to death the plainclothes soldiers who abandoned their uniforms, stole the garments of regular citizens, and were hiding in the refugee zones with weapons and ammunition, he wrote in the book. China says Japanese troops killed 300,000 people in Nanjing from December 1937 to January 1938. That's like a month and a half. A post-war Allied tribunal put the death toll at about half of that. Would I remove the book during the Olympics just because they're Olympics? That's really stupid, he said at a ceremony to mark the publication of the book. His firm has 72 hotels, either built or in the planning stages in the Japanese capital, which suffers from a hotel crunch that has planners fearing a shortage of rooms during the games. He also says Korean women who worked in wartime brothels, the so-called comfort women, were not coerced. He's a broadband denier. Slowly and steadily, opponents of the 2020 Tokyo Summer Olympics are being heard despite the overwhelming sense of national pride surrounding the Games, according to the Asahi Shimbun. Their criticism against hosting the event ranges from ballooning costs, well, just don't go ballooning, to exploitation for political purposes. Dozens of uniformed and plainclothes police officers recorded protesters' words in January. When group members expressed opposition at a meeting of the Tokyo Olympic Bid Committee, attendees called them unpatriotic. And a new budget released by Tokyo 2020 appears to have cut over $5 billion in operating costs for the Games after pressure from the IOC. That was easy. Tokyo organizers' new budget projects the 2020 Olympics will cost a total of $12.9 billion. Addy's got that on him. This budget includes the $5.6 billion Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee budget. That's a lot of organizing. The rest of the budget would be provided by the Tokyo Metropolitan Government, that's the taxpayers, as well as other levels of the government of Japan, that's the taxpayers. Previously, Tokyo 2020 had put an $18.1 billion cap on budgeting for the Games. Last year, reports showed hosting the Games could be a $20 billion expenditure. The governor of the Tokyo Metropolitan Government immediately expressed concerns over the rising costs, pledging to come up with solutions to reduce expenditures. Initial solutions proposed including moving Olympic events outside Tokyo. The IOC was worried about the situation, pushed for the creation of a four-party working group to address the rising costs. For more than a year, Tokyo 2020 has been under pressure by the IOC to state its costs more clearly. Those unclear facts, that they're hurting us. Tokyo 2020 President Yoshihiro Mori was quoted by local media apologizing for the delay in determining the allocation of costs. Tokyo has just over 3 years to deliver its obligations to host the 2020 Olympics, says the president of Tokyo 2020. Preparations have fallen behind by about a year. We have to catch up. Let's all tune in, won't we? The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all have to catch up. Every day. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, on the Mighty Soho Radio in London. It's all mighty. It's matty, matty. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast from Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, TuneIn.com, and iTunes, and WWNO.org. And it'd be just like getting some clear facts if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Already, thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, yeah, it still exists, email. And I read them and everything. Join the conversation. The playlist of the music heard here on, and your opportunity to get Cars I Talk t-shirts for dads and grads, all at harryshearer.com. And me, I'm on Twitter. Yeah, there's still Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. Show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station for the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from New Orleans.